We're gonna skate to one song only.
Down, Mark the Game Changers in the house. I got my man D Wills on the line. Both of us feeling a little bit like we just fell out of hurricanes. Just like I got dropped out of a tornado.
That's right.
You know, real sports guys, as the moniker goes, as the name is. And we got real lives, we got real things going on. Just very hectic, very, very hectic. Last couple of weeks for the Game Changer. D Wills is always in the middle of something, so you know his life is always going at a breakneck pace. And our man Phil T, Sports PhD, is up on the shelf. We got him on IR for this week. He's inactive. You know, check the injury report. We're gonna be real Belichickian about that. But you know he's not active for the game. Maybe it's a shoulder. Maybe it's a knee. You know, maybe it's a sinus infection. Who knows? But he's out. Now he's not feeling well. PhD's not feeling well, so we're going to hold him down tonight. We got you. We're going to roll with the two-man booth. You know, we're going to go Madden and Summer All on him, and we're going to keep it real crispy. All right. So, well, before we get into what we're going to get into this week, I was absent last week. You know, I'm coaching girls basketball. It's really a big deal to me. Really important, and I try to put everything I got in whatever it is I'm doing. So I had to miss last week because we had a coaches meeting, and we try to get everything in order as our season gets started. But the fellas held it down. I need a recap of just kind of how things went. What are some things? What was some stuff that y'all talked about last week, D Wills? Why don't you fill me in?
Oh wow, God, it seems like it's so long ago. But I mean, we kind of got into a little bit. Of everything. In some ways, we got into a little bit of the midseason report because you weren't with us. We kind of looked back at, you know, what did we say was happening at the beginning of the year, and then, you know, where were we now in terms of our picks and what was happening with the NFL. Obviously, we talked a little bit about Tebow because the Tebow and that's going on. You know, we reflected a little bit on, you know, obviously with some of the ongoing developments in college sports in terms of what's happening with the Penn State situation, which is continuing. I mean, I think we're seeing so many different things in which fringe of college sports is being impacted by a whole bunch of things. And I think they're coming to question about in terms of, you know, who is really running things on these campuses? It's you know, stuff that we're kind of talking about there. And, you know, obviously we spent some time getting into the games and things that were going on. So it was a lot going on. We had our technical difficulties. We were going in and out. You know, we went backyard on them a little bit on that in terms of really trying to deal with some of our technical stuff as we were working through. And then Ray joined us a little bit while we were having that conversation. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about a lot of the things in the bubble and issues in sports, you know, how we do it. You know, we kind of combine societal issues in sports. Sports is a microcosm of our larger world. And, you know, we held that theme together. We had L-Dog come on. Larry came on and, you know, offer some perspective for us. So we had a great input from our regulars coming around the table with us, and so it was a typical one. We didn't feel good because we didn't have a game changer with us in the house to add that perspective, but we tried to hold it down.
Well, I'm sure you guys did, man. I'm sure you guys did. So that's a recap of last week, and I appreciate that, getting me up to speed. You know, that helps me kind of keep that, because what we like to think that this is less of a radio show and more like a continual conversation, like a continual stream of consciousness. All right, and so we don't like to backtrack too much. We don't like to rehash old ideas because that gets redundant and that gets boring for the folks out there. So, you know, I just wanted to get up to speed and make sure that I'm abreast of things that went down with the fellas. But I'm sure y'all held it down and y'all kept it tight. So what we gonna get talking into talking about this episode of The Real Sports Guys. And again, if you want to call in, feel free to. We always welcome that, 1-347-989-0844. Feel free to get on with the Real Sports Guys at any time this evening, kick a hot 16. We just ask that you don't come weak. All right? So what we're going to get into tonight, first topic, first thing we're going to get into, it's that time of year again, all right? Every year it seems like for the last 10, 13, 14 years, every year we get to this time of year, around Thanksgiving, and a certain sound just begins to echo throughout the sports radio world. And I'm sick of it. I'm sick and tired of it, man. I'm sick and tired of it. Every time, every year about this time, we get all of the national pundits, even the local guys, complaining about the BCS. And how it's a flawed system. And they put microphones in front of coaches. And, oh, it's a flawed system. Oh, we need a tournament. Oh, we need a playoff. I'm tired of it. I don't know about D-Wills, but I am sick and tired of it. It's like, let's package this up every year. Around this time of year, we're going to start to complain about the BCS. We're going to have people to complain about it. We're going to have people in favor of it. And we're, you know, wash, rinse, repeat. You know what I'm saying? And I'm tired of the conversation. I'm tired of thinking about it. The BCS is what it is. It's the situation that you go into every year. You know the rules of it. And at this point, I don't like the BCS. But college coaches just need to shut up and play with it. All right? Just play with it. It is what it is. All right? You know, what was the one chick from the Bad Girls Club? Char? What her little calling card? Her little calling card was play with it. And that's just what they need to do. They need to play with this one, all right? Because it is what it is. You knew what it was in August, and it's not going to change. It hasn't changed. Just stop whining about it. If your team ain't in a title game, you're not. You know, until these schools start to play tougher non-conference schedules, you know, play somebody in a non-conference. You know what you got. You got to put yourself in a position because these SEC teams, the conference is loaded. It's four or five ranked teams in the conference at any given point during the season. Their strength of schedule, as you see by the current BCS rankings, where you have three SEC teams in the top three spots, their strength of schedule is ridiculous. It just is, and there's not much that can be done about that. For some of these other conferences, other than playing some tougher competition or going undefeated. So, you know, that's what you're looking at going in. As long as the system is the way it is, there will be an SEC team in the title game until something changes. And everybody else has to realize you either got to go undefeated or you got to have a hell of a schedule to compete with the SEC. It's as simple as that. So I'm tired of it. That's all I got to say about it, you know. That's all I got to say about it. I'm frustrated. I'm tired of this stupid conversation, complaining about it. We need a playoff. Everybody's okay with it until this time of year. Then all of a sudden, we need a playoff. We need a tournament because my team is out. Shut up. D Wills, you take it, man. You take it.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's one more example of you know, college sports, and you know what's driving it is the business. And the current format allows for us to have a championship, at the same time allows for the pageantry of bowls, which is a fundraising activity for most institutions. That's why college presidents are not going to vote for it. It's not because it's funny, because I heard either Bobby Bobbin was talking today, and they keep using this lame excuse about, you know, class. You know, he was saying that, you know, in baseball they can play two or three games a week, and basketball they can play two or three games a week, but football you only play one game a week. And stuff. It's not about class. I mean, they do it in Division II and Division III. They figure out how to have a playoff system, and it works. It doesn't take those kids. And those kids in Division II and Division III are taking much more mainstream coursework than most of our folks who are playing in the highest division. So it's not about it's going to be more time for the athletes away. That's not the issue. The issue is they're finding a system that allows for some energy around a national championship game, at the same time allows for folks to benefit from the kinds of things that happen in bowl games. And this is about as close to that kind of balance that they could have without tipping it one way or the other. So that's why it's not going to change. And so, yeah, I agree with you. Don't cry about it. What I'm going to see, and I talked to you guys about it off air, is I'm seeing a shift that I think is going to happen over the next couple of years in some of these conferences that's going to challenge the SEC a little bit more. I think if Urban Meyer comes in and coaches at Ohio State, the trends that we see with Michigan, because some of these programs come with cachet, historical cachet, that if they have any kind of decent winning season, they're going to be in a national championship game, no matter what happens in the SEC. That's why Ohio State was always in the conversation. And certain programs like Michigan, Ohio State, just like Oklahoma, if they're 11-1 or they're undefeated, they get into the national championship game. It's because they come with that cachet. And I think you're going to see a conference like the Big Ten begin to make some shifts with Nebraska coming into the conference and the kind of energy that's created around that. And if you get Urban Meyer or some elite coach like that at Ohio State, you already see Michigan making this rise up. And I'm telling you right now, and I called it last year, I said Michigan's only problem was all they had needed was have a defense that was in at least the 50s, and they're going to win 10 games. And you see that played out right now. And with Madsen, that defensive coordinator, he's going to be attracting. Michigan's always been able to attract top talent. They've always been able to have superior talent come there. So all they needed was the right coaches to continue to have that thing come. So you're going to see some shifts. You know, SEC is still going to be good from top to bottom just because where they have strengths is really in that front seven on defense. They don't win on offense. Their offense is – you look at the offenses are dominating offenses. It's on the defense, and it's the front seven. That's the difference. And every once in a while, you get a team like LSU has got a secondary. That's crazy. And what Big Ten teams used to beat SEC teams is they used to be balanced at receiving. And so they could challenge those defensive backs. They didn't always have to go up head up against them in the run game. And that's why historically, if you look at the record over the last 20 years, other than Ohio State, Big Ten teams have had success against SEC teams. And so the SEC is always going to be good from, you know, top to bottom, have more balance at the lower side than the top side, be better in their front seven. They got more depth in that front line. Those things are going to be there. But you have programs like Michigan, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Nebraska. Some of these programs, if they're playing well, they're always – are going to be, if they're 11-1, they're 12-1, they're going to be considered in the championship. But the system is what it is because it provides the best balance between the benefits of a bowl event and being able to produce a national champion. And as long as college presidents get that kind of balance, then they're not going to push that over. But that allows Toledo if they go to the bowl in Detroit to still raise money, to still do those kinds of things they need to do that don't normally happen if you don't go to bowl events. And so anybody who looked at a bowl schedule knows how much of it is a fundraising activity. And that's why college presidents aren't in favor of any kind of any kind of playoff system.
You know, I want to talk to more about this Big Ten versus the SEC and where you see the Big Ten going. So, you know, you got Nebraska, it's a solid program right now. Michigan State has seemed to turn a corner. Ohio State is still a plum of a job. And if they lure Urban Meyer there, which I think they will, because if they're talking to him, as a coach, if you have an opportunity to get into an Ohio State, a Florida, a Texas, an Alabama, and a USC, one of these blue blood programs in football, you really can't pass it up. I mean, if Urban Meyer were to say, I don't want to take the Ohio State job because I'd like to continue to wait, for what? So I think they're going to lure Urban Meyer. You got Ohio State, you got Michigan, you got Wisconsin. I think, though, what is hurting the Big Ten is that back seven.
Yeah, you know? I think where you'll see the Big Ten go, and this is how Michigan used to do it, and Ohio State was do. What you'll see them do is they'll balance that with their out of conference schedule. So you're going to see them play, they'll have those home and home types of events. So you might see, you know, a Michigan, you know, they might. Michigan used to do this. They would play Florida State. They might end up playing Florida. You might see them match up against an LSU. You might see them do that kind of stuff to create that buzz early on in the season that they do. And where the Big Ten teams are going to get it is if you can already see some of the swing. You see Michigan State's offense. You see Wisconsin's offense. You see Michigan where they're going to be going. Where they're going to make it difficult on these SEC teams is they're going to be running this pro-style offense. And where Big Ten teams have advantage of a lot of folks is offensive line. But they also, mm-hmm. teams like Michigan, can recruit skilled players. And usually, and what I always say that with these Big Ten teams and the heyday used to do, they recruited skilled players who ran disciplined game routes. That's why teams like Michigan kept, they look at the number of cats in the league. Look at Breston. Breston in the league, he played at Michigan. Now, Breston wasn't even a star on Michigan's team at that time. He was a good player. But look at the number of skilled players they put into the league. And that's why they've always played well against SEC teams, is because they didn't always have to run at the teeth of that defense. Where they had the advantage sometimes is they had these skilled players like Breston out there who could make big plays. At the same time, they had these running backs. And so what you'll see is where they'll make up, well, I think they'll make up the differences in their scheduling. So where they might lose out on Indiana, SEC teams might still get credit for Ole Miss, is that they'll schedule some out-of-conference teams that'll give them a bit of strength. And that's what Wisconsin's got to learn, is that they got to get at least one big-time out-of-conference team in those first 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
I absolutely agree, man. I totally agree with that on Wisconsin. They have to step outside of this little comfort zone that they got if they want to be a big boy program, like a for real, big time, big boy program. They got to step outside of this comfort zone that they have and play somebody.
Yeah. And it could be, you know, you ain't got to go and play Alabama or LSU, but you know, Penn State's playing Alabama. So you already see the model. You know, the way we do this, the way we break this down is we start playing you. And what happens is, if I play you every year, I start getting used to who you are. I get over that stuff. My freshmen have now seen you. By the time they're seniors, it ain't nothing new.
Right.
And that's how Michigan used to do it. That's why they used to play the Nebraskas back then. There were years when Miami was good. They played. I remember when I was growing up, they played Florida State. Then 2 weeks later, they played Miami after playing Notre Dame. Now, that was crazy. But you know, you could taper it back a little bit, but I can see that type of scheduling coming back into some of these Big Ten teams to start playing. And if you win one and then you start to go undefeated or 11-1 in the Big Ten, now your strength of schedule looks good. And that might just be with SEC teams. That might be playing top teams in the Big 12. That might be playing, you know, some teams in the Pac-10. You know, you might be Pac-12. That's the way that they'll have to balance out that strength of schedule in the conference kind of thing. So that's where I would see them doing it. But in the bowl games, if you look at it, over the last 15 years, Big Ten teams had a winning Big Ten's had a winning record against the SEC. What people get warped is in the big game, Big Ten does not look good. So, and then mostly that's Ohio State. So if you Google and look at Big Ten record against the SEC, the team with the losing record is Ohio State. I think there might be one other team in the Big Ten that got a losing record.
But again, you got to look inside those numbers. Is that because Ohio State is always playing an upper tier SEC team? Well, you may have, you know, a Michigan clip of Tennessee.
But we just said SEC is dominant throughout their schedule. So you can't say SEC is dominant throughout their conference and then say, well, everybody didn't play LSU, Alabama.
But what I'll say is there's a difference, though, between Alabama and Ole Miss. There is a significant difference.
Not by the rim.
There's a palpable difference.
I'm talking about on the field.
I'm talking about if you got on the field and you playing Alabama, and then next week you get on the field and you play Ole Miss, you're going to feel different. It feels different. There's two different levels.
But the argument they use with SEC is that that's not that different. You got to see, this is the stuff that killed me about the SEC. When you make this argument about you got a winning record against the SEC, then they say, well, if you're not playing Alabama, then they quit ranking their strength of schedule in.
But I think this is what they're saying.
I can say the same difference. It's a difference between playing Ohio State than playing Northwestern.
But what I would say is that I think the difference is that though there's a difference between Ole Miss and Alabama or Ole Miss and LSU or Ole Miss and Georgia or Ole Miss and Florida, that difference is a difference between a top 15 team and a 45-60 team.
But the thing about it is normally when
I think the bottom of the Big Ten is more like 75-100.
But what I'm saying is that normally when those games, let's say it might be out by a Capital One Bowl, that's normally an SEC team with maybe two losses. That's usually somebody that was either finished second or third in their division.
Right. Which means that, but ultimately that means they're fifth or sixth overall. That means they're fifth or sixth place overall in the SEC. If they're second or third in their division.
When Michigan beat Florida under Urban Meyer and Carr's last year, well, I think it was just last year, that was a good Florida team.
Yeah, it was, and that was a good Michigan team.
Yeah, so, I mean, we talk about when Wisconsin been whipping them. When Wisconsin, they went out and whipped some good teams in the SEC. They didn't just go out and just lose, you know, they didn't just drop it. So what I'm saying is, usually it's a solid matchup. It's not the games that we watch recently. Those are usually solid matchups. So it's like yeah, Ohio State hasn't represented well against LSU. LSU, like this year, LSU and Alabama are different category. Right now, they're different category right now. Defensively, they're different category, not offensively.
Yeah, those defenses are I think they can hold a pro offense to about 20 points.
Yeah, those defenses are elite. Offenses, mediocre. You look at those quarterbacks.
I agree with that totally. I mean, that's why the game was, what, 6-3, 9-3,
yeah.
Something crazy like that.
The SEC, except for a couple of teams, have decent offense. Great defense. When they win his own defense, they got great defenses. They keep the games close or whatever. Their offenses are not elite offenses. I mean, the years that Florida had some attack, they had some elite offenses, but SEC on par are not elite. They're elite defenses.
So they're not elite offenses, but I think where they get you is that they wear you down. Their second and third line guys are oftentimes worthy starters at pretty much most other programs in the country, which is where I think offensively they start to wear teams down. I totally agree with you. Just on a simple scheme, being able to put points on the board, their offenses don't scare me. Like, no SEC team has an offense that I'm like, wow. I mean, Auburn's offense was nice last year with Cam.
Yeah.
But none of these teams this year have an offense where I'm like, yeah, that team could put up 50 on anybody or put up 40 on anybody. But I think they kind of grind you out. They grind. They count on their defense to keep it close, and then they wear you down offensively, and then they get it. You know, they'll beat you 17-10. You know.
And that's what I mean. So I think if you're thinking about how can the Big Ten, let's say, in this challenge, I think the Big Ten is the best conference. I think in the best position as a conference to challenge the SEC. I don't think, and I think
everybody else right now is in disarray, other than the Pac-12.
And the Pac-12 has not, other than USC. And USC is the ultimate SEC killer. So to me, the one team that's basically been a one-man wrecking machine to the SEC has been USC. They bludgeoned even the top. When USC was at its best, they beat the best of the SEC. So that's the one team you got to put out there. Even in the heyday, SC was, when they had the minor conference games, they bludgeoned the top SEC teams. That might be the one team, the one program that can kind of hold it down for everybody else. And you can see they're on their way back because they usually have the speed on defense, and they usually have the speed, and they have off. They do. I said about offense. They got offensive skill players and scheme that allow them to play well against SEC teams. And they usually have an elite quarterback. So I think that's – and I think Michigan used to have that type of setup, and Ohio State used to have – the thing that killed Ohio State was the fact that Trussell was so damn conservative. I would argue Ohio State had all the talent to win those games. I said what killed them is Trussell being so – he was so conservative, and it benefited him most of the season, but against SEC teams, he needed to open it up and have more of an attack mode. That would be my argument with Ohio State, is that I think Trussell was just too damn conservative, and it cost him in those games. He didn't let his talent play when you watched him play. So that would be the one that I would question on that, but SC has been a killer on that. The SEC is talented in a lot of different space. I mean, it's going to take some time to do it. But I just think people's will, that's the thing about will. There's a will to come back and say, y'all just not going to be running other with us. And I can already see that bubbling up.
I think especially after this year, I mean, everybody else has to stand up and say something. You got to do something. You got to make a statement and say that, look, man, because everybody else is behind the eight ball. I mean, I get why people are upset, but then I'm tired of them people being upset about this.
Yeah.
You know, I get why the Stanford coach is coming out, you know, saying that the BCS system is flawed. Hell yeah, it's flawed. But it was flawed. It was flawed last year. It was flawed the year before that. So, you know, do something about that. You know what's going on. You know what the rules of the game are. You know what the rules of engagement are when you come into the situation. As long as everybody is aware of what they're dealing with, there are no surprises. Ain't no surprises with the BCS right now, you know.
And then ultimately, play better against Oregon.
Right. Win your games.
Win your damn games. Everybody knew you was doing that with smoke and mirrors. You didn't have one receiver. You playing with three tight ends.
Right.
Y'all are not the New England Patriots.
You play to win the game.
Tell him, huh? Tell him.
Hello? You play to win the game.
I mean, your defense is back a little slow. They look like they're running backwards. It just, they can't, they just, you knew you. It was just a matter of time. You lucky you have luck.
Right. Right.
So you're the wrong person to be complaining about it. The team that could probably complain, that could have complained, and then they got shellacked and whacked was with Oregon. So I think you got to win in the system. This is it. The thing that pissed me off even more than the SEC teams is I don't understand this infatuation with the Big 12. You can make an argument to me about the SEC, but you can't tell me why. And this is the part that I get pissed off about. Wisconsin loses on 2 last-second touchdowns. Oklahoma loses to Texas Tech, and they get beat again, and they don't even drop out of the top 10.
Yeah.
Now that right there is flawed. I could not understand. And I'm saying that is the conspiracy piece you look at. Wisconsin loses the 2 last second, and it was like they couldn't wait to drop them out of the top 10 on Hail Marys.
Yeah.
Hell, if that happened to Oklahoma, they'd still be ranked number 4.
Yeah,
kill me.
I can't argue with that. Nope, I can't argue with that. I agree. I think, there definitely is a bias towards certain teams with the polls. And as long as that plays a factor into what happens with the BCS, there's going to be a bias, man. There just is. I mean, as well as Wisconsin was playing, as brutally as they were dismantling teams, it didn't matter.
Yep.
It didn't matter. Is the system flawed? Yeah.
I thought that with every Big Ten team, other than Ohio State, holds it every once in a while. But it's like if you lose, you out. It's like they can't wait to throw an SEC team on a Big 12 team up there. It kills me when I look at that stuff. And the Oklahoma one, I just can't understand it. Somebody got to explain it to me.
Or even Oklahoma State. I mean,
yeah.
I think Oklahoma's getting by on rep because, and you know, the other piece that I think that is big in this, and this is something that I've kind of always noticed, and it's kind of a conspiracy theorist in me, because Game Changer is probably about 35% conspiracy theorist. If you were to, if you were to tease out the ingredients that make a game changer, I'm about 35% conspiracy theorist. So with that, I'm always watching these ESPN College Game Day promos, and right before a team plays a primetime game on ESPN, they somehow sneak into the rankings. You know what I'm saying? One of the teams that's kind of one of those fringe around 25 to 30, they always sneak up into the rankings like the week before they play on ESPN. And I'm always like, they ranked? You know what I mean? I can't give a specifics the last time it happened, but I know it's happened quite a few times this year where I've looked up and I've seen a promo for a game on ESPN. And I'm just shocked that, like, they snuck back into the rankings? Oh, that's interesting. They got 3 losses.
Three losses.
But they're playing on ESPN. So when you have a major network who's partnering with the NCAA, who's partnering with conferences, also conducting a poll that also plays into this whole BCS formula, I think there's also an issue there. I think there's also a conflict of interest there. Where, this network wants to get games that people are going to watch. They have a poll. I don't know if they inform how people vote. I don't know if they do that. But I have noticed.
Yeah. And one of the things that we're talking about is like a lot of, and what's holding is not even a computer. It's that these human polls are the one that's holding some of these teams in. And it's like, are these folks even watching the games? It's like we got to have a better way. I mean, people used to say, well, you got to get people who play the game. I'm like almost saying, give it back to the writers because the writers actually watch. Somebody do something, but it's just like, it's like they're not paying attention. And I've been watching it. I've been, like, paying attention. I'm just like, the Oklahoma one, I don't understand. It's like they got pictures on somebody. Like,
well, you know, they do. It's Oklahoma. I'm sure there's a powerful booster somewhere who is invested in the BCS in some kind of way, you know?
Because I'm saying, what would it take for Oklahoma to get dropped out of the top 10? And it's not losing to Texas Tech, who is terrible. Baylor is good, but not great.
Right. Again, Baylor, that's another example. That's another example. Baylor sneaks into the rankings last week because they got a big game against Oklahoma. I look up and Baylor's 22. I'm like, yeah, Baylor's been putting in work like that. You know, they always give them one of those spots towards the bottom of the rankings, and they just sneak them in because they got a big game coming on either ABC or one of the ESPN networks. That's one. That's one that caught my eye.
It's quite a phenomenon. That they got going on, and so it's college football is I don't know where to go with this. I mean, you basically talking about teams being a national championship game and not play for a conference championship,
right?
No one's
right
about that,
right?
You know, how can you put a team in a national championship game if they don't win their conference or at least play in the conference championship game? It's almost like people are stealing money and nobody's complaining.
What's going to happen is there's going to be two SEC teams in the national championship, and everybody else from every other conference's head is going to explode.
That's right.
And nothing's going to happen. We're going to be back with the BCS next year, and the BCS is still going to be the system that we use, and that's going to be that.
Because all those teams, when they go to their bowl game and that booster writes that $2 million check, it's like, I feel better now.
Right, right. I'm good. what were we mad about again?
We got this new facility up. I mean, that's kind of how the game rolls. So, yeah.
Right.
I
got this new Cherry Wood desk.
Sometimes it be what it be. Sometimes it be like that.
You know,
just get over it. Roll over it. Just enjoy the sun out here in sunny California. That's how it's gonna roll. So, but I'm just like no one's saying anything that, you know, the team that's gonna play in the national championship game didn't even win its division and didn't play in the championship game of its conference and didn't win the conference. That's basically okay. And that right there is. And the way I look at it, people say, well, Alabama's clearly second best team. Look, back in the day in the ACC, when they only allowed one team to go to the tournament, yeah, that second team was always great, probably the second best team in the country. They still didn't go to the tournament, but they didn't win the ACC conference. I mean, that's way back in there. That's way back before
right.
Even people who might be listening. So sometimes that's the issue of being in a tough conference. And then what you do is you debate. You're like, we can make a debate that Alabama, who finished second in the division, could have been in the national. I mean, that's the kind of debates that happen afterwards. But the bottom line, the only way you qualify is by winning your conference championship.
Yeah.
Like, how can you be in a national championship game if you don't even win your conference?
And that's why I think if this whole super conference trend, you know, it heated up for a while, you know, in September, with teams just playing musical chairs for a moment, I think that died down because, you know, there was a lot of backlash publicly. But I think once the season is over, you're going to see more of that. You're going to see more people trying to broker deals and maneuver themselves into the super conference format. I think that ultimately is going to be what finally ends the BCS, because it will be more about how good the teams are and less about who won a conference. Because just as you could say, you know, well, Alabama didn't even win their conference, they don't deserve to play in the national championship. Whoever happens to win the Big East this year, I don't think deserves to be in the BCS Bowl.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they will be. So it's a double-edged sword, and it hurts teams and it benefits teams, this whole format. But I think the Super Conference format will take that away because conference championships honestly won't mean that much outside of the school, outside of that conference. And the conferences won't mean jack because you got 58 teams in a conference. You're going to have 58 teams in a conference. So because you won the conference, you know, nobody's really going to care. You know, it's like having bragging rights amongst a bunch of guys you don't know. You know, it's like being in a public fantasy league and you win and now you have bragging rights, but you don't have anybody to brag to because nobody really knows each other. Nobody's familiar with one another. So, you know, that's what these new conferences will be like. And ultimately, I think what we'll see is more of an emphasis on how good are actual teams, and we'll see more of a tournament format develop from that. They may still keep the bowl format. I don't know how they would sort all of that out because that to me, that just seems like it's going to be very difficult to do. So, you know, I think the Super Conference idea really threatens the BCS more than any banter by coaches or talking heads on the television, which, again, as I said before, I'm just sick of, man. Like, I'm not going to get up in arms about the BCS. Again, it is what it is. It has its flaws. It has its benefits. You know, yeah, it sucks that a team that didn't win their conference championship is playing in the national title. But, hell, you got a messed up system, crazy stuff going to happen.
A game changer. I do have a special guest on the line, and, you know, he joined us a few months back. He's a dean of our show, and it's good that we're kind of talking about college sports, and wanted to get his perspective because, you know, he played for Digger Phelps for a little bit when he was at Notre Dame, and has spent many years in higher education working, mentoring a lot of college athletes, have been working with coaches, definitely has a perspective, and I know we've been talking about this stuff, and so I thought that it'd be good to have our guy, Jeff Thompson, join us and shed a little bit of thought on some of the issues we've been talking about with college sports. And, Jeff, welcome to the Real Sports Guys. Welcome to our show. We're glad to have you here tonight.
I'm gonna pause you for a second, D. Wills, before we jump in with the Dean. You brought in a Thompson. I'm going to raise you a Thompson. We got PhD. PhD, you in the house?
Well, I'm gonna
what's happening, baby? What's happening?
I'm just gonna say to all you guys, you know, good evening, and let's talk the titles out because that's exactly what happened with Penn State. Okay, let's just go there. Anytime you have a person that's ruling the roost like Joe Pa has, then exactly this is what I would think the chicken's coming home to roost. Okay, so I'm just gonna start out right there with some real I think statements about not just college sports, but also the people who are in power, and now this is what's happened. Obviously, it's a terrible thing what's going on at Penn State. Would you like me to start?
Yeah, go ahead, and I know we've got PhD online. I hope your voice is doing well. I hope you're doing it. But, Def, I want you to just talk a little bit about, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about, you know, have institutions lost a sense of priorities, you know, have athletics taking over too much power on campuses? What's been the impact on athletes? You know, maybe just talk a little bit about your perception. I know you do have some thoughts on this.
Well, my major thought to this, folks, and that is this. Anytime you have a sports factory or a sports revenue-producing institution like Penn State, Notre Dame, any institution that brings more money than you ever can imagine, and then can disperse that money, and you have people who are running those programs who are really have bigger titles, bigger, I'm going to say their reach, not just their institutional reach, but their reach that goes outside, keeping people quiet, okay, dismissing people, taking people's priorities away. I really, really think that the Penn State kind of really, really kind of hammers things down to what's really wrong with institutions and institutions being married to sports that really, really produce huge millions and millions of dollars to our sports. and to institutions. And I really, really think it's kind of a it's a shame. It's a shame. But it's not just about Penn State, and it's not just about Joe Paterno. It's about how institutions have really made a deal with themselves, which is the devil.
So you spend a lot of time with athletes, and you know we've been talking about how do they get can they really be student athletes, right? And in this day and age, and what should happen? And we've had some discussions about should you pay athletes, all these different things. What's your position on what's the impact on these athletes, and what would need to happen for them to be positioned to get what they need to get out of this situation, whether it's money or it's education, or what do you think should be happening with these athletes?
Well, number one is athletes, in my opinion, should be deprogrammed from their athletic departments, in a sense where they really think you should see a separation of church and state. As for paying the athletes, why not? I have no problem with paying the athletes a stipend, more money. They can use that money towards anything they want, but I can't see why. University has made money off athletes for decades. It's no longer just about the athlete, in my opinion. It's about how the institution can get as much revenue as they can from athletes. I think that a case in point, I would think, would be the Fab Five. I mean, Michigan certainly has one of the, if not the largest alumni in the world, and yet the Fab Five brought more fame, brought more notoriety, brought their jerseys, their uniforms, black socks, black sneakers. I think the whole cult of hip hop merged with the Fab Five. I think that's probably the best statement that I could give. Okay, I also think. We should have advisors, who really, really can not just mentor athletes. This is outside the athletic department, so I'm talking about professors, academic administrators, deans, academic advisors, and they're not beholden to the athletic departments at all. I think athletes should be able to go to summer school and not have to be in a year-round regimen to keep their bodies in shape. I think that's a wonderful notion, I'm saying, but we all know as long as the athletic departments have control over these athletes, they'll be programmed for one thing, to be eligible, okay, to be in, I think, programs that don't really produce their dreams and their passion to go beyond the athletic field, and I really think the institutions have to really, in my opinion, they have to retake the university. And they really, really have to start thinking about the athletes as people, as human beings that go beyond the athletic field.
I'm asking a lot of questions. Any other questions, Game Changer? I know you got opinions on this. Phil T, you on the line. Any other questions y'all want to throw out there?
Yeah, I got one. So you mentioned a separation between church and state. I mean, I like the way you put that. What are some examples of how it used to be separated?
Well, here's the thing. Ivy League schools don't give athletic scholarships, okay? Ivy League schools give stipends, okay? I think that if you have seasons, okay, even though you have conferences and you have conferences, seasons really, really should not start, in my opinion, until the grades are in. I really think you can start the season with two or three preseason games or something like that, but all these super tournaments and slam jam tournaments and Hawaii tournaments, you wonder why? I mean, really, who's really running the asylum, number one? And you expect the athletes to be students as well? You expect the athletes to take a full program load and to come to school and to be in review sessions and learning sessions, tutorial sessions? That's an unrealistic. That grand experiment has gone down the drain. I really, really think we should start thinking about students. If you're going to give them athletic scholarships, give them stipends. Let them go home for Christmas. Let them see their parents. Let them see, their communities. Let them have summers off, right? Give them the choice to have more control over their lives. If they're behind in credits, give them a chance to come up, catch up in credits. Don't use up their human spirit.
I truly enjoy how you put that. And, I was on my commute home from work the other day. I was thinking about this whole idea, and I was thinking about the idea. You could even say I was meditating on it. I was meditating on this idea of how could, in what way could a university make it so that this scholarship that they're giving this particular athlete is actually worth what they get in return from that athlete. And this is what I came up with. And you know, Game Changers are radical in this way, right? So I think all the way outside the box, right? I live outside the box when it comes to stuff like this. What they should do is not only do they give that athlete an athlete a full ride, tuition paid, full cost of going to college, however you want to put it, athletic scholarship, but all of his direct descendants, they should give athletic scholarships. To me, that's an even trade. To me, that's the capital, that's the upward mobility, that's the capital that you should get from a college education. And to me, that's a fair trade.
Excuse me for interrupting. I love what you said, but we might as well put an amendment and put reparations too. You know what I mean?
Hey, but you know what? If they, but call it what it is, though. Call it what it is. Because the amount of money that they make off these athletes, why not? Why not kick back and allow this person, not only this person, but the rest of their family to eat well for the next generations? Because there's some athletic director, there's some college president, there's some bowl game director who's getting that same benefit, actually. They're getting that same benefit in the monetary form, where they're getting money that is going to allow their grandkids, you know, line after line of descendants of those people are going to be able to access education and other resources that may stop once this athlete turns 32. And his access to those resources, his ability to transfer those resources on to his descendants is going to stop. So if you want to say that's an even trade and you want to keep the system the way it is and you want to leave it be, then that's my augmentation. That's my hookup. That's how I changed the system. And I said, if you're going to give a kid an athletic scholarship, then you sign it on to give his whole bloodline an athletic scholarship. Do you really want to do that? But let's make it mean something. Let's make my whole idea is, let's make the scholarship actually mean something.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing is you're having these kids come to your universities, your institutions, and you're really, you know, you're pulling a switcheroo on them. You know, you tell them we're going to allow you to come to our school. They're coming in, these coaches come into these kids' living rooms and ask them, so what do you want to study? Oh, yeah, we have that, we have this, we have that. You know, ultimately knowing that this kid ain't going to step foot in a chemistry lab, that this kid ain't going to step foot in the engineering building, that this kid ain't going to step foot in the school of education at their institution. They know that. So, you know, they show you one thing, then when you get on campus, they pull a switcheroo, and you're dealing with something else. And a scholarship really doesn't have the meaning that it should. You know, I'm all about education. I'm all about the power that education offers, especially for young African-American and Latino people. But that whole go to school on a scholarship and learn what you want to learn, and do what you want to do and then walk away with the degree that you want doesn't always play out the way it should, you know. So that's where I took it.
You hit a couple of good things here. And the one thing, Jeff, you're on, and I'm
Let me drive you home.
it's real sports. My daughter's not here with me, y'all. But what I would like to say is real sports, real pickup. And I think I'm all on a whole nother thing right now. I'm on a Bluetooth
headphone.
Yeah, hear me now. One of the things I'm trying to say, I want to also say, I think Jeff also talked about. Now, Jeff, did you tell me this earlier? He said one of the things we should do with coaches' salaries is they should not make more than two times what the college president or chancellor is making. Is that what
well,
you're saying?
Well, here's what I think. I think this. I think that if coaches are going to make that salary, that they need to donate. They need to donate, okay, money to every athlete that doesn't graduate. They need to give that money back to the family.
Mm.
And that person, okay, remains on scholarship until they get their degree, or they can have a viable job that pays them a salary, all right, that's transferable to their degree that they should be getting. That's what I think. I think the coaches owe the players and the players' family a responsibility. And that responsibility is that if they don't get that degree, they have to find a job for this young man or young lady for 5 to 10 years.
Wow.
Or give that money back to the family.
Yes.
So I want you guys to hear me. I don't think you can put a cap on how much money a person can make. But I also think it shouldn't just be the coaches who are making that money. But I also think anybody who's making in that six-figure salary, the president, the chancellor, the provost, everybody should have a stake in trying to close the achievement gap, not just with students of color, but with students at the institution. And if they don't, it comes out of their pocket in some kind of fund that helps students who don't graduate.
Yes, I mean, that's a strong point because, you know, all of us who play college athletics, you know, and even going back to high school, those coaches, I mean, coaches have a certain authority and influence on students, you know, on student athletes. Why? Because they control playing time. You know, at the school I'm teaching at now, I have 3 or 4 student athletes, Division I basketball players, and, you know, if that coach calls or shoots an email about their performance, those kids respond right away. You know, Jeff, I want to throw this out to you. I had mentioned a few weeks ago, and we had talked about something similar to this, that I think that a Division I program should contribute or put money aside for graduate education for these student athletes. You know, even ones that go to the pros, there should be 2 or 3 years of graduate money there available for them to use whenever they want to tap into it. What are your thoughts on something like that?
I think you're absolutely right. I agree. It should be anything that enhances that family or that student athlete to further their learning, to further their work employment, or to help the family. I think we would see a lot more effort in getting students graduated, but we'd also see a lot more students, a lot more of the administrations working with families. So many times we hear coaches say, I'm like a father figure to this kid. I think those are empty words. Those are hollow words. And really, it's anathema to the families because it serves a deep-seated betrayal that exists between athletics, departments, coaches, and families. Anybody understand what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely.
Ooh,
absolutely.
William Agee said this. You remember William Agee? Sister from Hoop Dreams, he said, everybody keeps saying, don't forget me. Don't forget me when you make it. And he says, at the very end, don't forget me if I don't make it. And we have so many people who don't make it, and people have forgotten about them. We have people who are graduated from this college campus who are working, maybe for an athletic department, who feel used and exploited by the same system that supposedly has given them a job to further their education, and still they feel like there's no support, there's no resources, there's no staffing, there's no promotion. We really, really, really want to help these kids. Let's put these kids in a position of leadership, mentorship from the very beginning. And it doesn't always have to come from the athletic departments.
And that's what it's supposed to be about.
But it doesn't seem to play out that way. Why don't you think it plays out that way? Because, you know, when you hear people talk about it, that's how it's presented. When coaches come into your living room, that's what they present to the student athlete, is that you're going to have this experience. It's going to change your life forever for the better. It's going to open up doors and opportunities for you when you're done playing. And for some athletes, it does. But for a lot of them, it doesn't. Why is that?
Well, if we had the answer to that, we all could be millionaires and going on the ship with Divine right now. That's the question. In my opinion, that's really the ultimate question. And that really fits in with Paterno's whole notion of the grand experiment. I really think that coaches really believe what they're saying is the truth. And it is the truth at that time. What happens is coaches can't do it all. Athletics departments can't do it all. Support programs and systems can't do it all. It needs an institutional commitment to find out what's worked, what hasn't worked, and also believe that the answers don't always have to come from the athletic department or from the higher administrative levels of the institution. I don't think there really is one simple answer. But we have to know one thing is okay, and we can't lie to ourselves. It's not working the way it is. And that's from The Wire. That's Bunny Colvin.
That's how we roll, The Wire.
The one thing we can't say is we can't live off a lie anymore. And if the biggest statement that Penn State has said is that this came from their house. They were supposed to be CBS, the CBS of college athletics. They were supposed to want to have set the standard. So this should shine a flashlight on everybody. This should raise the accountability to everybody, because the people who are suffering, okay, are the people who can't fight back, whose voices are silenced, but it's long. And this should make us think about our own house, and that no one's perfect, but we all should hold ourselves accountable to what we see, to what we hear, to what we should be vigilant to, and that is how we protect people who can't protect themselves.
And in some ways, athletes can't really protect themselves.
There you go.
Right? And that's what we, because you talk about young people who haven't developed the capacity to understand everything that's happened around them. If you take a traditional age 17 or 18 year old coming to a large campus, and you think about what they're struggling, I mean, three of us on the phone have sat at that table with those first-year students and know all what's buzzing in their mind. Now, you add the layer on top of that, of what you experience as a Division I athlete, with everything else that it comes with practice, with space, stadium, all this other stuff that comes, these are young people who are not in a position to really understand what's happening to them. And that's where folks get taken advantage of. Because you're often, particularly in some of the top revenue sports, also dealing with students who are most likely first generation, most likely coming from homes that are low income in terms of finances, and so are not coming with the support systems to understand what they're going into. So, you know, this is about protecting themselves, talking about, you know, a dream that is at the initial conversation of recruitment that says you can do all of these things, and the reality is they can't do all these things. And the frustration that comes from some of those student-athletes when they believe they're supposed to be able to do all these things and they find out they can't do the things that they want to do. We have to figure out how we help them go through that same transition, that balance that we allow all these other college students to go through. And that's why some of the things I know, Jeff, you're talking about in terms of at what point is enough? At what point do we need to start coming back? What point do we need to provide, you know, space for these students to have the same type of reflection that other undergraduates have, where they can just be doing the academic work? They're not always doing something in preparation for athletics. You know, we work with student-athletes trying to figure out how to allow them to go study abroad. And the challenges that go along with that, And some of those challenges are just with NCAA rules. I mean, how can you talk about the things that are important experiences for undergraduates to have, and you've limited athletes to have access to that? So I think there's layers and layers of it, and that's why I said we've got to a point where it's clear that we have misplaced priorities, right? That who is speaking for the greater good of society on these campuses? Have chancellors and presidents lost their positioning on this? And, you know, it's hard to tell a person who's making three times what you're making what to do. Right?
Well, you're absolutely correct.
I mean, that's a tough thing. Bobby Bowden was saying that that his replacement is making like twice, three times what he ever made. Plus, he gets $1 million bonus after the first year. And I thought Bobby was making money.
And talk about salt in the wound, he only making that because of what Bobby did.
That's it. Jimbo Fisher is getting paid. When you have assistant coaches, that some of these top assistants are making $1 million. I mean, that tells you we've lost some perspective on this. And when you do that, things like that happen at Penn State. We have stuff that's evolving at Syracuse. We got all kinds of stuff that's evolving are going to happen. So,
if you're one of these predatory cats, if you're some sort of social predator, an athletic, unfortunately, a Division I athletic program is a great place to hide yourself. It's a great place to hide yourself. It's surrounded and insulated by an old boys network. All right, everybody's focused on staying in the black and increasing revenue. And oversight, the body that oversees it is only focused on looking at student-athletes and looking at the indiscretions of student-athletes. And that's why you have agents. Because, right now you have the situation at Penn State. You got the situation at Syracuse, but there have been predatory cats taking advantage of young people in different ways for a long time through Division I athletics, whether you have these agents, hangers-on, people giving these kids loans, you know, point-shaving scandals. All of these are predatory acts against young people. You're taking advantage of those who may not have the experience and intellect to make the right decision and to protect themselves, because these athletes are still young adults. They're still young people. They're still coming into their own. They're not 30 years old. They're not 25 years old. They're still very young, very impressionable, easily led astray.
I think you made an excellent point. I just want to just comment about predators, okay? Now, I don't really think that we could draw the analogy between a pedophile, a child pedophile, and a person who preys on people's vulnerabilities and naivete. And I just want to say that. But regards the whole spectrum about what Devon and what you said, you know, about how the institutions themselves have lost institutional control of what really is integrity. We try to teach kids integrity. We try to teach each other integrity. But from the highest level, if they've lost their integrity about how we educate students, not how we use and exploit students, not how we bring in agents, we bring in people who want to have these jersey signings and stuff like that and punish people the way we did Dez Bryant and A.J. Green from Georgia because they're at someone's house and they take a dinner and you want to sit them out the whole season. It seems to me that a lot of the punishments, okay, that young African-American students have are a lot harsher than what Sandusky's getting, than what Joe Paterno's getting. They're disgraced. They're getting disgraced. They're getting news in the paper, faces in the paper, you know, and everybody wants an answer. Everybody wants to have a fact-finding, independent counsel, okay? No one's going to say about these kids, okay, like Penn State is going to pay for these kids' defense. Penn State is going to come after each other. And if you looked at the news today about Joe Paterno, he said that he does not encourage his kids to snitch on each other, to lie. He says they have to lie. And it's the line to protect themselves? Well, of course. Is it the line to protect the program? Better still. Is the line to protect his image? Better still. So if you really look at collegiate sports, where they're living off a lie and encouraging the kids to lie and at the same time preaching integrity. There's your grand experiment and there's your grand contradiction right there.
Well said. So with that said, I want PhD while he's on. I want him to jump in. Where are you at with this whole situation, PhD? We haven't talked in a minute. How you doing, brother?
You know I'm
doing well,
okay.
Man.
Everything. You know they're working me to death over at the university, but that's okay. That's what we're supposed to do.
Right.
Phil is just laughing in the background. Huh?
Oh man,
I'm just trying to wear my white shirt and tie and come to work every day and do what I can do. And you know what? That's what we're supposed to do.
Right.
Go on, let me hear your question.
So here's the question. I'll pose it to you. I want Phil T to answer this one first, and then I want you to jump in. All right. What should happen at Penn State? You brought up the idea, the phrase, lack of institutional control was thrown around. What should happen?
Is Phil T talking?
Phil T, you there? I'm not, because I don't have much of a solution, man. I really don't.
What should the NCAA do? What should the penalty look like? Should there be a penalty? Because key phrase, I think, is lack of institutional control, and to me, that's what this is. So under any other circumstances, this would result in a harsh penalty.
I don't know. I might be in the minority here, but I'm still taking the position that we need to know more what's going on. And even if, hypothetically, Paterno did know about Sandusky and didn't do enough or didn't do anything, I'm still not convinced that this is somewhere where the NCAA needs to step in. Just simply because, I don't know, I mean, you look at the places where they have stepped in, and I just don't see this as a place for the NCAA. That's just my position.
Okay. Now I'll contrast that with the idea that to me, I think the NCAA definitely needs to step in, and I'll say why I think the NCAA needs to step in. I think the NCAA needs to send a message that this type of behavior is even less acceptable and more punishable than the things that they punish student athletes for. Simply on those grounds, if we found that an institution were covering up guys getting or selling memorabilia, guys getting trading memorabilia for tattoos, we're going to sanction that program in some kind of a way. If the NCAA found out that the institution covered that up, they would levy some sort of disciplinary action upon an institution. The institution covered up something way worse than guys trading memorabilia and other things for tattoos. It was centered around an athletic program. Something needs to happen.
I mean, I see it more as there was no competitive advantage gained or lost in this situation. Student athletes were not taken advantage of. You know, they weren't, there was no grade scandal. that's why I just don't see it as an NCAA type of issue. And I know the NCAA covers more things than things I just mentioned, but at the end of the day, they're not a legal entity. Okay? If students are getting money, if student athletes are receiving money, well then yeah, that's a game, a competitive that's a competitive game. That's a risk in their amateurism. And again, I'm not saying what happened there was right. Obviously it was wrong, but I just don't see it as somewhere where the NCAA needs to step in. I mean, institutional control in my mind is more of, you know, students are getting like they're receiving more benefits in the classroom than your average student is. What happened there, you know, with a kid being abused, I just don't see that as a loss of institutional control. I see it as, you know, perhaps, I mean, I just don't see that as institutional control. I don't.
I see it as institutional. If a child is being molested on your athletic facilities and you fail to do something about that because you're protecting your brand, I believe that your institution has lost control over what's going on in your facilities. If you can't even control what happens in your facilities, I think that's a lack of institutional control. Because, again, this isn't just a criminal act that happened on campus. This is a criminal act that happened and was allowed to happen and was aided by the use of the athletic department and particularly the football program's facilities. And no, it didn't involve student athletes. It involved coaches. These are the people who are supposed to be leading these programs. It involved coaches and administrators. These people are just as responsible as student athletes for behaving themselves in a certain way. And if the NCAA is going to come down on student athletes for violating the rules that they've set in place and for behaving in a manner that is supposed to be, you know, maintaining amateurism, whatever that's supposed to mean, I think there needs to be some standards for how those people who are leading these young people need to behave themselves and need to respond to certain situations. And so to me, that's where there's a lack of institutional control, because those that should have been addressing this issue did not. And they were allowing, again, like I said, if you have some predatory tendencies, a great place to hide yourself is a Division I athletic program.
I'd like to jump in if I can, and I got to get my beauty rest for tomorrow because I got to get up early tomorrow and serve these kids, okay? So thank you for coming. But I want to say Penn State is between a rock and a hard place, number one, okay? And this is a very sobering, you know, discussion that we're having, and everybody says, and I agree with this, that our hearts should really go out for the kids and their families, even the kids who have grown up who still have to live with this nightmarish moment in their lives where they were not protected. Institutional control is a tricky word right here, and I just want to say this, that I think that that Penn State's going to have to live with this for a very long time, and I also think it'll never be Penn State again. The standard has fallen, and I think that it's going to be very difficult for them to cover. Do I think that the Penn State University should be punished? I think Penn State University, especially the coaches, okay, and the administrative branch that deals with what happened or what they knew or didn't know regarding a cover-up, I think that needs to be dealt with in a legal manner. I still think we're digging up information, and the more information that we're finding out, the worse it gets. But do I think we should shut down the football, the athletic program? No, because then you're hurting the athletes who had no responsibility whatsoever. They went to the university believing the university is what it is. And certainly...
But, Jeff, I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you. I got to interrupt you, though. In every situation where there are sanctions levied, they always hurt the athletes who didn't have anything to do with it. They never get – Reggie Bush is not at USC.
Do you drop football? Do you drop basketball? Do you drop women's volleyball? Do you drop any of the sports that are involved? Or do you go after the people who are responsible and they have to pay that price? And I think that that's what should
happen. No, you don't drop it, but you sanction the program.
But what
you sanction the entity that made this decision so that they continue to make money. They made these decisions so that they could continue to make money. What you do is you then hurt their ability to continue to make money.
Well, guess what? Their ability to make money, in my opinion, has already happened. It's already happening.
See, you stopped them from going to bowl games. You stopped them from going to bowl games. You limit their scholarships.
No, I don't think
you stopped them from being able to make money because they sacrificed the innocence of these children so that they could continue to make a buck on the brand of Penn State.
Some people at Penn State, just like some people in the government, just like some, it's not everybody now. Penn State is responsible for some areas of what has happened that has gone wrong. Do I think Penn State will have paid its price? Absolutely. Do I think it deserves harsher penalties? No, because it's received its harshest penalty from, in my opinion, the court of public opinion.
Yes, but many benefited from the decisions of that sum to hide this.
I do.
People got raises.
I do think
because
it is more responsible should be punished to the fullest extent of the law, and I think that should play itself out. Now, remember, we're still in the information gathering, and I think that's very important. We want to really be careful about leaping to conclusions. We want to get as much information out on the table, and it should happen in a legal way. Because
right, and what I'm saying is once that happens, what should the NCAA do?
I think
that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that. I'm saying whatever is found out, if there are improprieties that took place on that campus and Joe Paterno and people above him within the athletic department, within the infrastructure of that school knew what was going on and they did nothing, the NCAA has every right to levy sanctions upon that school.
The NCAA really can't do anything because it's out of their hands.
No. It's not. What happens in court is out of their hands. As far as their football program goes, which is where this took place, the NCAA can say, we're going to ban you from bowl games. The NCAA can do that. They can't send anybody to jail. You're absolutely right.
I'm not going to go that far, respectfully. But I will say this, okay? Penn State has a hell of a public relations problem, and they have a hell of a legal problem. Hell of a legal problem. And I'm more of the person for saying let the legal system take its course. Let's get into more, as much information gathering as we can. Let's find out who's responsible, when they knew it, when did the cover-up take place, how long did this go back. We're finding out that just start in the 90s. And that a pedophile just won't stop. A pedophile, I mean, supposedly the profile is supposed to be is that it starts at a very, very young age. And usually pedophiles have been abused themselves. And I'm not excusing that behavior at all. But let's see where this takes us before we leap to conclusions. And I think that we all deserve to hear the truth.
And I totally agree with you on that. I'm not leaping to conclusions. What I'm saying is that, again, if things are found out to happen, I think the NCAA is within its rights. I don't think the NCAA would be out of bounds. Again, they've claimed lack of institutional control for universities covering up way less than this. This was a university. If this comes out the way it seems like it's being portrayed right now, this is a university cover-up. And if it comes out that this was a university cover-up within the athletic department, around the football program, I think that is institutional control. It has to go beyond just competitive advantage. What is institutional control? Because all that says is we don't care what you do as long as you're not creating an environment where you're winning illegally. And again, that goes back to that idea that it's about just winning.
Are you saying that the university should just ban Penn State from bowl games for the next 5 years, limit the scholarships?
I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with that. If they're found, if everything that seems to be what is happening is found in court, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with those penalties being levied if they are found to have covered up what went on. And I'm all about letting the justice system do what they do. I'm not a lawyer. I'll let those that know do that. But what I'm saying is that if it is found out that Penn State covered up what happened, if the administrators
and the leaders at Penn State covered up what happened, then I think that, yes, they should be banned from participating in bowl games. Yes, they should have limited scholarships. Yes, if they are found to have known about this and to have not taken the appropriate courses of action to deal with it and address it and prevent it from happening, then absolutely. Because if that's found in the court of law, what penalty they're going to get is way worse than losing a few scholarships and not being able to go to the bowl games. So that's the least the NCAA can do.
I think the people who are responsible for what happened, I think they should pay a very dear price, just like the kids, okay, who are paying a very dear price now. I think that Penn State might go out of their way to even say that they'd be able to pay the legal fees. I think that's part of being accountable. I don't think anything will make up, okay, for what has happened, not just at Penn State, but across the country and the world regarding pedophiles, regarding child abuse, regarding rape, regarding any awful crime that's really a crime against one's human spirit and humanity. I totally agree. But I also believe that as much as the university has had little control and people who have covered up, I think they should be brought to justice. I think they're accountable. And I think the university is taking the proper steps, as we see now. I think an independent counsel is the first step to try to find the truth. Will we know all the truth? I hope so. Usually we don't come across the truth that easily. So I'll leave it at that. I wish you gentlemen well. Is everybody there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, hey, we look forward to having you join our call again.
All right, you take care. God bless for everybody.
Nice.
All right, man, take care. That's the dean.
See, we get provocative on this one, y'all.
Yeah, for me, I don't know. I feel that the NCAA is very quick to punish and throw the book at athletes. And again, the whole idea of competitive advantage to me is a loose term, because I don't think paying a kid or a kid getting some tattoos gives him a competitive trading memorabilia for tattoos gives him a competitive advantage on the football field. I don't think that creates a competitive advantage at all. A school giving money to recruits, because I think most schools are doing that. I don't think that's something that's new. I don't think that that's something that's happening at select places. I think most of the schools that are winning, and not all, but the majority of the schools that are winning, there are some things that are going on that they could be tagged for. I mean, you look at all the up-and-coming programs. Boise State had allegations. Oregon had allegations. North Carolina had a program that was on the cusp of becoming more competitive. They had allegations to the point they had to get rid of their coach. You know, University of Miami has had allegations 5 or 6 different times. So all of the top programs, USC, Ohio State, most of the top programs have had some sort of cloud of suspicion around amateurism and competitive balance. So my thing is, if these top programs are doing it, and they're the ones who are winning, and they're the ones who are winning all the trophies, where's the advantage? They're competing with each other.
Well, and I think part of the problem with this is that and y'all have been talking about it. It's been an incredible discussion. Is that most of the rules are about the athletes and none about the folks who are making the most money. So this is an example again. I think it is the NCAA's responsibility to investigate anything related to its operations. And that part of being a college sport and having the privilege of having a revenue sport like that shouldn't be just about the competitive advantage, but it should be about what it means to have one of those, to be allowed to have one of those programs on your campus. And so what is that all about? And I think part of it is institutional control is about operating it at the standard that is expected of a program working with student athletes. So I think that's what creates the opening of the door, that it goes beyond competitive advantage. And then if you found that you did not have institutional control, so part of it is you had somebody who was a coach, who was now emeritus, who you had a sense was doing some of these things. You, in all programs, student athletes volunteer, you knowingly had your athletes involved in the operation with someone, possibly, knowingly. So if they find out that you knew this, and then all of your student athletes help to drive notoriety to that charity that was the feeding ground for this activity, then that's a problem. That's loss of institutional control. Right there, that's the problem. Because Second Mile was the main volunteering activity for student athletes at Penn State. And if you continue to have participation until recently, knowing that you had these kind of allegations sitting out there, that's an issue.
And I feel you on that, Devon. I totally feel you on that. And I'll break it down even more simpler than that. You want to consider yourself a D1 school. You want to consider yourself a D1 accredited athletic program, right, who is a BCS, a partner in the bowl championship series, and a part of the football championship division, or whatever it's called, the football championship bowl series, whatever it's called, the FBS. Then the least you can do, is make sure a pedophile doesn't have access to your facilities and is using it to take advantage of children. That's the least you can do. Let's leave it at that. That's the least you can do, all right? Damn everything else. Just make sure nobody's dying, nobody's getting hurt and maimed in your facilities. Can you do that? If you can't do that, then that's lack of institutional control. Okay? If you can't do that, plain and simple, if you can't do that, then you need to look at what's going on in your facility. You need to look at what's going on in your program. And I think they're taking the steps to start to do that. But again, if you can't oversee and make sure that those kind of things aren't happening, then I don't know.
I mean, if you really think about it, in some ways if the alleged allegations are true, there's all kinds of violations around fraud, a whole bunch of things. So, in what example is it okay? Knowingly to be okay for your athletes to be involved in an operation that may have some illegal activity?
Never.
None.
And so if that's part of it, then I think that that's what Emirates and NCAA is saying that they have to look at. All of these things that create that scenario, and I think that's healthy. Because the operation is more than the athletes; it's about everything around it, and I think that's what's been the problem with how things have been working recently. That it's all been all about the athletes, and no one else who's benefiting from that enterprise is under any kind of regulatory oversight,
right, or any kind of scrutiny, unless they're providing benefits to athletes.
That's right.
And that's why this can happen at an institution, is because it was so far removed from the athletes.
I mean, to me, that's why this is a case study. Because it tells you that it's not just about the athletes. And so when you're sitting there doing this restructuring of rules and everything else, part of what you got to do is, what kind of oversight do you have over everyone else in the operation? I think that's part of what they have to look at.
Well, there's so much
how do your rules cover the behavior of everyone else?
I mean, there's so much of a focus on the actual student athletes. Okay, let's make sure that this student athlete isn't getting too much money from this booster, or they're not working at too many camps in the summer. I mean, all the focus is on the student athletes, and there's minimal focus on the coaches and other folks within the program.
Yeah.
And right now, the system is set up about the student athlete. It's not really focused on different. I mean, this whole scandal rocks the system. It rocks the system, and because the system's not set up to handle this. You know, my dad put it really well. He said, you know, back in the day in the 1800s, it was, you know, when they played football, all of a sudden somebody did an onside kick. And it's like, wait a minute, can we do that? I mean, you know, the rules aren't set up for this. Well, the rules don't say we can't. So, I mean, the system just has to, you know, laws come into play because somebody did something wrong. And there wasn't a law to make them go to jail. So, I mean, the system just is not set up to handle this kind of thing. And that's why I think it's such a big-time gray area.
I mean, one of the interesting things that Bobby Bowden said today in the interview about it, because when he asked, is there imbalance? Do big time college basketball coaches and football coaches have too much power? And Bobby Bowden, who's a legend, said yes. But he said it's how you use that power. And he said, you know, I realized I had a lot of power, but I realized that I had to be very careful about how I use the power. And one of the things he said was I learned from someone that said, if you want to test someone's character, give them a little bit of power. And to me, that was just, you know, incredible insight around it, is that I think people talk about the kind of power that they think these coaches have. But I think in this circumstance, I think people begin to realize to the extent of that power. That even in the most heinous kind of situation, allegedly, if it's true, even the most heinous kind of situation, that the power is so crazy that if you can be protected in this situation, what else can you be protected in, right? If you can be, if this is true, if what is alleged to be true, if you can be operating this way, and the protection of the brand is so important that you can still be protected in a heinous crime like this, What else can go on?
And that's why ultimately I think the NCAA has to levy some sort of sanctions and say, look, this is as we say in the schools, this is below the line behavior. All right? Here's the line. Right now your behavior is below the line. And we need to say that this is not okay for our member institutions. This is not an okay way to behave. For our members, if this happened in the science department, y'all handle that as a university. We ain't going to touch that. That's the science department. You know, if this happened in your engineering school, y'all work that out. If this happened with one of your NCAA-sanctioned athletic programs that is a part of a bigger entity, something should be done. That's how I feel about it.
So let me ask you this. At Texas in Austin, there was an administrator in the athletic department. I think it was an assistant AD. You guys might be familiar with the story. He just settled some sexual harassment suit of a former employee. Okay, are you guys familiar with that story?
I'm not familiar with that story, but keep going.
Okay, so my question to you, Marcus, and also you too, D, is this a situation where the NCAA needs to step in? Because if I'm correct, I mean, if memory serves me correct, I don't think the NCAA stepped in. This is something the institution and the legal system took care of. And sexual harassment, child abuse, I mean, they're about as close as you can really get to, like, put something else in the same conversation.
What I would say is if it was found out and the institution stepped in and did something about it, then you know what? I'm okay with the NCAA not stepping in that situation. Again, my issue with the whole Penn State situation is that there were people involved and the athletic program was used as a tool to prey on children.
Mm-hmm.
and it was used as a tool to prey on children and those who are in a position who were in a position to stop it did not. And those people happened to be prominent figures within the football program and within the athletic department. And so what you have in this situation that I think is the difference is if this guy is using the football program to lure in women to then take advantage of in some kind of way, then Mac Brown knows about it, and Mac Brown doesn't really address it. Mac Brown says he may have told people, says he may have not done enough or whatever. The police wasn't called, which is really the only proper course of action. Then, to me, yeah, the NCAA needs to step in. If this is just two adults, one woman, a woman feels that she was inappropriately addressed or talked to or touched, and then it's reported, the institution levies some sort of disciplinary action upon the employee who did this, the offender, then I don't think the NCAA has anything to say about that because the institution did what they needed to do to address the issue.
And
I don't feel that in the Penn State situation, and again, this is just my opinion as of right now, as more information starts to come out, that my opinion may change. But as of right now, I feel like, based upon what I know about the situation, Penn State did not do enough to effectively address what was going on. And to me, that's where you get lack of institutional control.
And I would say that's no different than, you know, if you think of, we just there talking about, you know, Malcolm Floyd getting a DUI. I mean, there are certain things that happen to student athletes that are issues, but NCAA would not be involved in it. And so you can separate those things. What's important about this case, I think, Marcus, you got it into the arena where you would probably bring them in when you think about leveraging the programs, using the programs, but also it's involving student athletes. So the other part of this is that part of the thing that Sandusky was involved in, which was part of the alleged crime, involved an organization that also heavily involved student athletes as part of the process. And so that is an area where then you have to bring the NCAA into this, right? So, you know, to what extent were these athletes being used as part of this? Who? What kind of control do you have in terms of evaluating non-for-profits, volunteer opportunities, checking out the background of organizations before you expose your undergraduates to these organizations? So it brings in a whole nother layer of institutional control that they think you should have. Are you putting athletes in a space where they can be taken advantage of?
Well, check this out. Check this out. These kids, these young men who were taken advantage of, were not coming to hang out with Jerry Sandusky. They wasn't coming to hang out with his old dusty behind. They were coming because they were getting access to Penn State football players, Penn State facilities. That's how these kids were lured in. That's the web that he wove, and he caught little kids with that web. He wasn't just saying, hey, come hang out with me, I'm Jerry Sandusky. He was saying, I'm Jerry Sandusky from Penn State University. He says, I'm Jerry Sandusky from Penn State University. I'm connected with the football program. I can get you access to this, this, and this with the football program. That's what that was. That's a totally different – that to me, that is, as you said, as you're talking about, Devon, leveraging the athletic program for illegal activities.
Mm-hmm. So I think I think the NCAA is in a position where they can discern that. They can figure out when it's a case that is a sexual assault that is might be a criminal nature that is not program related. Just like they don't jump in on every issue that an athlete's involved in the community that might be, you know, underage drinking and all that stuff. You know, I don't think they get involved in all those things. They leave that to institutions to monitor. On those issues. And then even some issues that appear that might possibly be minor violations, if the institutions have done their own internal work on it, then, you know, they might not be flagged. It might be
they might be flagged, but they might not receive any penalty on it. So I think they're in a position to be able to evaluate to the degree of when you get involved and when you don't. But if it's clear kind of use of the program for illegal kinds of things, those are the things that NCAA, I think, is well within their to review and to figure out if there are any kind of sanctions and figure out if there are any some of the things that they've done with coaches who have been censored in a way that, or I forget what they call the term, where you know, where an institution has to make a case within 5 years if they're going to hire them. So there's things they can do with these coaches that don't allow them to move from institution to institution without being approved by the NCAA. They just did that with your guy that was with Oklahoma, and then what's my guy who was coaching Oklahoma at that, and then moved on. Now he's in the NBA. They did that stuff with him. So he can't really get hired for a job. I think he has to be approved over a certain period of time. They have to show cause why they really need to hire him. You know, no institution is going to try to hire you when they got to go back through that many hoops to hire you.
Right.
And so there's things that they can do to even affect mobility of coaches, which I think, because I think sometimes these things happen and then coaches just can move on to other jobs, but the kids are left and the schools are left to deal with it. I think the NCAA could do more to sanction coaches and limit their ability to be mobile.
And for me, here's the hypocrisy of the idea that Penn State shouldn't get any sanctions. Devon, you can vouch for this, and I'm sure you can vouch for this too, Phil T. You hear student athlete X has got into a bar fight, has picked up whatever kind of a charge, and then you don't hear about this kid again. Why? Because he's been released from his scholarship. He's off the he's out of the program before the legal process has even taken place. In some situations. Mm-hmm. So, and we've all heard of examples of that, where a student athlete does something. Devon, you've heard of Badger players. You know, we've read about Badger players who've been charged with this, and they never set foot on campus again. Or we never hear about that particular athlete again, to the point we don't even know what happened with the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so programs do this with athletes. They distance themselves from the athlete, or they just tell the athlete, hey, you need to go home. Or whatever they do in these situations, it happens. And so for us to say that Penn State shouldn't, it's not within the NCAA's realm to sanction Penn State. You know, I think as a university, they do this all the time to athletes. They levy sanctions against athletes all the time for things that don't create a competitive advantage. But ultimately, they hurt what is going on in the kind of culture they're trying to create in their programs.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is one of the biggest issues with college athletics, is that the NCAA doesn't have enough teeth around creating an environment where there is some accountability on these institutions, whether it's moving your school or moving conferences or whether it's, you know, all of the things that go on within a program. The NCAA needs to be a solid oversight of all of these programs. Otherwise, you do have this kind of free-for-all money grab, which is basically where we're at right now, where these institutions are making decisions based upon what they want to do with individual entities and not really thinking of the whole, but thinking of themselves and how they can get a buck. You know, whereas in other realms of sports in the pros, you don't have that. You're not going to have – you know, the New England Patriots aren't going to say, man, we would be better off served if we was in NFC East. So we're just going to go ahead and switch conferences because we'd rather play against the Giants and the Cowboys. We'd rather get some of that money rather than worrying about playing against the Jets, who is really, you know, right now our only rival. You know, the Dolphins are down and the Bills are down. And so we're not bringing in revenue playing against those teams. So we'd rather go to the NFC East and play against Philly and D.C., and the Giants and the Cowboys instead. So that's what we're going to do. No, because that's not good for the competitive balance of the league. And the league would step in and say, are you crazy? No, you can't do that. That doesn't make sense with how we're structured as a whole. Yes, that makes sense for you as an individual entity, as an individual franchise, but that doesn't help us as a whole be successful.
And I would say, I mean, I think it goes back to the point that Jeff was making, that there has to be a commitment to that student athlete. If we're really serious about you being a student athlete, whether you're making some of these mistakes or not, like we do a lot of other undergraduates, we're going to be working with you through this because we made this commitment. We didn't make this commitment until, you know, you mess up. We said we're going to make this commitment to try to see you through. And I don't see that, you know, when they've gone for those year-to-year scholarships where you can, you know, they're non-renewable, you know, they're not over 4 years, it changed the dynamics for the athlete. And so I think we really have to think about those dynamics. We got to think about some institutional control around salaries. You know, I think, does it make sense for, you know, your president to be making $300,000, but then your coach to be making $4 million? You know, yes, they should make money because they're bringing revenue in, but should that be more around $1.2 million? You know, it's you know, and because at that point you're making enough money. How does that also play with, you know, your ability to get endorsements? Should you be getting endorsements? Should that be part of the gig? You know, after you're making $1 million, do you also get another $1 million or $500,000 in endorsements? I mean, where does that all go? How does that make sense in the equation? So it's those kinds of things that chip away, and none of that stuff is part of the oversight, right? But that creates that culture, possible culture of corruption, right? So I think that's the kind of stuff that, and so then where's the commitment to the athlete, you know, that we're going to really be, you invested in being here. And I think Jeff put it best, the chickens are coming home to roost. It's getting, you know, you can't continue to make a case for this stuff when some of these things that just don't make sense. It don't make sense for Boise State to be in the Big East. What's the rationale for that? Right, but you're gonna talk as though you think we're supposed to buy it. So it's that kind of stuff that you can't keep saying that's supposed to make sense, and then we try to really fall back on this, you know, integrity and amateurism and all that stuff. It just don't line up. You know, there should be a rule that you can't move no more than four states in terms of a conference, or you got to stay on your side of the
field. Man, if you can't touch them, you can't play them.
That's right. Right. You should be in a conference on your side of the Mississippi. That's right. You're in a conference on your side of Mississippi or within a four-state region.
The Big East plus one.
Right. The Big East and that other school over there.
Right.
You know, you know, so, I mean, we're reaching a point where, you know, I mean, you already seen the U.S. Department of Education don't, you know, Congress might, you know, a couple more of these blow-ups, Congress will be in the middle of this. I'm telling you.
Which we don't need. We don't need.
We don't want. But
I want Congress figuring out some other stuff. I know that said a lot, but I mean it. I want Congress focused on some other things other than sports. Sports is great. Sports is fun. I enjoy sports. I love talking about sports. I don't want my politicians messing with sports. I ain't vote for these cats to regulate the BCS or tell universities which conferences to be in. That's the NCAA's job, in my opinion.
Well,
that's what you're there for. Do your job. Do your job.
I mean,
make it all make sense for the average Joe. Make it all make sense. Boy, you stay in the Big East. What are we teaching our kids? You're going to have cats thinking Idaho is on the East Coast.
That's
right.
And
that's not true.
You're already struggling with geography.
Telling you, kids is going to grow. We're going to have a whole generation of kids. Because I tell you what, man, I learned a lot about geography from sports.
Yeah.
And I don't think our kids are going to be able to learn that, to share in those lessons. The whole Penn State thing, man, the whole NCAA is, and where it's going and what it is and how it's going to look in 10 years, you know, 10 years from now, it's going to look totally different, and I'm convinced of that, and it's going to be a totally different setup, and if it's not, I will be extremely surprised. But things change. That's the way it goes. With that said, I want to transition into the pick six before we get off. We got about 5 minutes. We actually got about 6 minutes. So I want to get into the pick six real quick and get our picks on record. I don't have the records tabulated, and I'm not going to tabulate them on air. So that just gets messy. So here we go. We got D-Wills. First game, we're going to NFL. Thanksgiving, Turkey Day. Finally, a Detroit game that matters. It's been a minute. It's been a serious minute. But we got Green Bay at Detroit. D-Wills, who you taking?
I'm going for the upset. I'm going for Detroit. Upset. They've been struggling. I think this is a game that they – this is the hiccup. A short week. I think they upset Green Bay.
Okay. PhD, who you taking?
I tell you what, man. Growing up, that was the one week you could count on the Lions showing up. It was Turkey Day. And they – really, man, it's something
Way
about
fun.
Turkey Day. That's right. So I'm gonna take the Lions.
All right. I feel a connection with the Packers. They rolling undefeated. I'm rolling undefeated in my fantasy league. So I need to keep my thing rolling. They need to keep their thing rolling. So I'm going with Green Bay. All right. Game number two. An interesting game. We have the New York Giants rolling into the Big Easy to take on the New Orleans Saints. Bill T, who you taking in this one?
I'm going to New Orleans.
New Orleans. D. Wills, who you taking?
One, New Orleans.
New Orleans. Man, Eli's better. I'm going with Eli.
Wow.
I've been reading from the book of Eli all week. I'm going with Eli Manning. And the Giants. I'm going with the Giants in that one. On the road. I'm taking two road teams. It ain't Kool-Aid. I know how far I can throw Eli. I ain't picking them to go to the Super Bowl. But I think they're gonna sneak that one out. Alright. So last game, the Battle of the Hardballs. Another Turkey Day game. San Francisco killing it. Unbelievable. What are they? 9-1? Crazy.
Yeah.
Versus Baltimore, who is they got that whole Jekyll and Hyde thing going, man. I don't know what to make of them yet. I mean, it's Flacco. We know it's Flacco. So who y'all taking in this one? I'll go first. I'm going to take San Francisco. I'm going three road teams. Anytime Baltimore can't run the ball, they struggle. And San Francisco is really, really good against the run. They have two excellent inside linebackers. Defense is stout as hell. And I think that's going to make it hard for Baltimore to run. And when they can't run, Flacco ain't the same. So I'm going with San Francisco. D. Wills.
Yeah. I should have talked to my brother about this one because, you know, he's friends with both John and Jim. I don't even know what to say with this one. I'm going to go with the home team. I don't even want to see the handshake. They're going to fight in the field. I'm going to go with the older brother.
All right, Baltimore. You taking Baltimore. PhD, who you taking? We got about a minute.
I'm going with Baltimore.
Baltimore. Either I'm going to fall way behind this week because I'm going to gain a lot of ground, man. All right, we got a minute. College football games. First game, we're going to go rapid fire. First game, Wisconsin versus Penn State. D. Wills.
Wisconsin.
PhD.
Badgers.
I'm going Wisconsin. All right, LSU versus Arkansas is at LSU. I'll take this one first. I'm going LSU. PhD.
LSU.
D. Wills.
Take that three, LSU.
All right. Last one. Notre Dame at Stanford. PAZ, who you taking?
Stanford. Big.
I'm going Stanford. D. Wills.
I'm going Stanford. Go or going home crying.
All right, we got about 10 seconds left. Anybody got a dog of the week? I got a dog of the week.
Oh yeah.
I got a dog of the week. Let me play the audio, man. I'll pull up the audio real quick.
We need more dogs.
I miss the Coastal Carolina coach, man. I ain't heard from him in a minute. Yeah, I got Monty Ball, man. Wisconsin Badgers tailback. Man, kids scored 30 touchdowns this year. Freaking ridiculous. Freaking ridiculous. He has an outside shot at catching Barry Sanders' record. Two more games. Three more games, rather. So he has an outside shot. The record's at 39. I don't know if he'll get there, but it's a hell of a season, man. It's a hell of a season. So that's something he can always take with him. He can always say he did. He can tell his grandkids about it. That's a nice feather in your cap.
Yeah, he's balling big time.
Yeah.
Literally balling. Yeah, he's.
Now, you know, last week, Marcus, you had Tim Tebow as your dog of the week. I've been waiting all week to hear this explanation.
Absolutely, man. Tim Tebow was my dog of the week last week, man, because he is putting Elway and them in a hell of a situation, man. And I just love it, man, because, you know, we all looked at the Tebow thing as, okay, you know, this is castor oil right now. You know what I mean? This is too much cake. Your kid is sitting at the table whining and banging, we want cake. And you just let them eat all the cake they can eat. And then their eyes start to roll in the back of their heads. And his stomach started to hurt. And you like, see, you wanted all that cake? There you go. You got all of what you wanted. I hope you learned your lesson. Well, this is that kid at the table that keeps eating cake. And he's just smiling at you the whole time. Like, this cake is good. I like this cake. I think I want some more. And that's what I saw with Tebow, man. I watched that game against the Chargers. It was the Jets. The game against the Jets. And I'm watching this last drive, man. And I'm watching Tebow them down the field. And I'm like, what? This is working. It's an ironic dog of the week where it's like, you know what? You're not supposed to be doing this. You're not supposed to be winning games, and this was supposed to fail. And yet you keep finding a way to win. That's why I chose Tebow, because this is not supposed to go like this. This ain't how Elway knows thought this was going to go.
The classic one was Rex's face when he scored. Was classic.
Yes. You know, yes.
I can't believe what just happened.
Yes.
What's amazing about this, it's almost like Oklahoma standing in the top 10. It's so much smoke and mirrors, I can't figure that out. Is that they got in because of pick six by the defense. So the defense is playing well. It's kind of like, you know what this is like? Did y'all watch the movie The Green Hornet?
Yeah.
When your boy was fighting and then Kato came out and knocked everybody out and he was just standing up there like he knocked everybody out?
Right, right.
Defense is like Kato. And he the Green Hornet.
Right.
And they just eating him up and Kato back there like, I can't believe this. The defense, and, you know, it's just – and Elway was on the news this week saying, no, we haven't found our quarterback. He just said, no. He was like, we can't go 3-13 on third down. I mean, he's reaching. We can't go 3-13 on third down and go to a Super Bowl.
I'm telling you, but I'm telling you this, man. It is interesting to watch Tebow, man, because, like, I know he can't throw the ball. And I know the defense knows he can't throw the ball, but yet he can run it for some reason. It's just like, I can't understand. I don't understand why it works. I just don't understand why it works. Like,
yeah.
I watched him play twice just to, like, see, like, why is this working? Why are they winning games with this dude? And you're right. It's
well,
the defense. if the defense is holding – the defense keeps the game close enough where they can keep running the ball. And as long as the defense keeps it close enough where they keep running the ball, if you give Tebow the ball with 3 minutes left, he can run your ass down the field because you're thinking at some point he's going to throw the ball, and he's never going to throw it.
Or he might make one throw that teases you. You're like, okay, he looks like he's throwing this on a run. And he plays better when it's just kind of wild and out there kind of playing backyard ball. That's where he plays his best. So now they believe it. So now the defense plays even harder because they know if we just keep it close, he's going to do it. So now it's just kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And what do you do? What do you do? The one thing I thought about his situation is, in his defense, he's the one that really got hurt by the lockout because he didn't have OTAs. He wasn't able to work with the quarterback. So in some ways, you didn't get to have a full off season with him where he could have grown up a little bit, learned more about the offense. He really hurt because of that. So the question you have to ask yourself is, what could this kid do if he had a full set of all OTAs, off season, working with somebody? What would happen with that?
I mean, even if you look at the end of last season, the last three games last season, I mean, this kid threw for 280, 340, and 290. You know, different offense, different coach, but he can throw the ball. You know, I don't know if it's a confidence thing. I don't know if he's just not comfortable with the offense they have now. But towards the end of last season, he was putting out ridiculous numbers. Not ridiculous, but average to above average numbers throwing the ball. So,
his completion percentage wasn't bad at all. It was fluctuating over to 50, close to 60. I mean, it wasn't bad. So, you know, but he had a coach like he had what Josh Daniels. He had people who were committed to his success. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were, and I don't know how committed this coaching staff is to success. That's the problem he's running up against, is that he don't have the president not committed to his success, and the coach came in and he's not committed to his success. So, I mean, that's what
he, hey, didn't the coach say if we ran a conventional offense, Tebow would be screwed?
Yeah.
He said that in the interview. His exact
words. He can say that he's gonna mess on words. He really trying to protect his ego as an offensive coordinator. He on defense. I'm just saving my offensive coordinator.
Right. and remember they had that. Remember ESPN magazine ran that article at the beginning of the season. What if Mike Vick was white?
Yeah.
Tebow is white people's Vick, man. And I have to. Yeah. I'm watching Tebow. Like, is this how white people feel about Mike Vick? Because I'm like, man, this dude is not good. How is he doing this? Is that how white people have felt about Mike Vick all these years?
You know, the one thing that they did in Florida that they're starting to do now in Denver is they're giving him an extra blocker.
Yep.
And so the running backs are blocking for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Urban Meyer did his classroom thing. He said, you know, let me give you guys a little bit of a secret. What Auburn did last year and what I did with Tim Tebow, you know, I mean, it's kind of like in basketball where you got four people setting a screen for you. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm giving him an extra block, but the defense is not used to that. The defense is used to, you know, defensive line clogging up a certain number of blockers, linebackers coming in the field, and safeties coming in the field. When you have an extra blocker, that throws everything off. The whole look is just different. It's just uncomfortable. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's like you're driving and your windows are fogged up. You know, I mean, it's like you just kind of disoriented a little bit.
Yeah, it's like the Wildcat. I mean, that's what made the Wildcat work, is that it evened up the numbers.
Yeah.
It was more of a numbers thing than a schematic thing. And I think the reason that this is working right now is because with the Wildcat, you almost wanted them to, and maybe you want Tebow to pass the ball. You almost wanted them to pass the ball with the Wildcat. With this particular setup, it's still a quarterback back. Like, it's not a running back. I mean, you can debate whether or not Tebow is a better running back than quarterback, but, you know, it's not a running back. It's a quarterback. And so I think, man, I don't know why this shit works. I've been trying to figure this shit out for a minute, man.
Swear said, look, he described it. He said, I live in Denver. I spend time at practice. But he said, I've been around this. He said, they're in drills with no defense. And all the other quarterbacks are 5 for 5. And with no defense, Tebow is like 1 for 5, 2 for 5. Like, he's watching this. He said, you know, he's literally saying, I mean, this guy has no defense out there, and he's not on the mark. And so he's like, this is what they see in practice. He said, that's why they say what they say. But
right.
There's something about a guy that's like a game player, just like even like basketball. You had a cat that don't look like he's doing that in practice, but when the lights come on, everything seems to be right.
Yeah.
That's what Tebow is. He's like, he might not complete. He might go 2 for 13 in practice, but in the game, on that last drive, he somehow locks in. And
he does. It's crazy. It's like in the game before this last game. He was like, what was he, 2 for 9,
yep,
or 160 some yards or something crazy like, or no, it was like 2 for 9 for 67 yards. That's a 34
yeah
yard per play average.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, he only completed 2 passes, but I mean, like, he hit the one.
Okay.
He hit the one, and that's all he needed.
Beautiful pass. They said it was all.
And the beautiful thing is, like, I have him on my fantasy football league, you know, and I mean, this dude will like have -2 points, and then the last 2 drives, he'll end up getting me like 13 or 14 or 15 points.
Right. Totally,
you know?
Saving the day, saving his game, saving the game. Otherwise, he's worthless, man.
Just
do
player.
It.
That's
man, I'm telling you, I've never seen a player play this way, man. I've never seen a player be able to impact the game in this way. Like, you know he's not going to throw it.
None.
Like, he pump faked the dude last week, man. He was running, and he did a little pump fake, and dude jumped. You knew he wasn't going to throw that damn ball.
Smith, your boy Smith, was just, I couldn't believe he did all that. I mean, like, hold levers outside contain. Force him up. He's not going to throw it.
Right.
And he scampers us for 22 yards and a touchdown.
Let him throw it.
And
please.
They pan the Rex. They cut the Rex, and Rex is just like, I can't. Never leave. He was just, and I was gonna. I'm glad we're here. What is it? And the thing about it is, what does it say about Sanchez? You can't win a battle with Tebow. That's why I knew they were in trouble. Sanchez, you don't trust the Jets offense, and that's the games he always gonna be in, where the offense is shaky. You know,
hey.
He couldn't mess with Detroit because Stafford was on his game, and they just started scoring. He couldn't keep up with it. But,
man, Rex going to get him a quarterback this year. Rex going to get him a quarterback.
Go ahead.
Watch. Rex going to get him a quarterback. Hey, fellas, I got to get going, man. I'm on my fifth.
Yeah, Orton got waived. I think he's going back to Chicago if they can. I mean, hell.
I said the Jets should think about taking Orton, and just as a signal. I think Sanchez needs somebody behind him who's a threat to take his position. Because Brunell is not a threat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you need.
Yeah, Brunell's more of a mentor.
You need to bring Orton in and say, look, if we make the playoffs, you might not start.
Hey, fellas, I let y'all go, man, on my third throat lock this year, so.
All right, man.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hey,
check out that rank.com.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out, man. Yeah, so next week we're going 50 through 30.
50 through 30. Right.
Okay.
50 through 30, cool. So your bottom 20.
Cool.
All right, I'm looking forward to this, man. I'm looking forward to this. Hey, the thing I may do is I may give each of us like 15 minutes, and we'll start out, and one guy will just go through his last 20, and we'll talk about it. Then we'll do a segment. Then we'll come back, and another guy will go through his bottom 20. We'll do a segment. We'll come back. So we'll start out. We'll do funky editorial. Somebody will go through their bottom 20. We'll do 5 on the black hand side. Somebody will go through their bottom 20. We'll do pick 6.
and then somebody will close out the show with their bottom 20, and we'll just talk about it that way. That way it doesn't get jumbled up as to who had who where, and everybody has the time to, like, talk about their why they did what and who they moved and who they moved in and out. So that's, what I think, a way we'll do that.
Okay. All right.
Cool.
That sounds good to me.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Be easy, fellas.
Be easy, too.
Peace.